Hi, this is Paul Walker.
And Chris Radwell.
And you are listening to BDO's Cross-Border Tax Podcast Live. So today, this afternoon, Chris and I are going to talk about the whole new mandatory disclosure regime and what does this mean? What's happening? How do you fit in? How do you not fit in? And what are the reporting and penalties and things of the like that you have to worry about? I'll first cover the mandatory disclosures on reportable transactions. Chris will look at the notifiable transactions, which is slightly different, and then also the surprising uncertain tax positions and how that will affect clients that have those positions in their audited financial statements. So, with these rules, essentially what's going on is finance wanted a system where they would get information sooner than later than on your normal filing requirements. And they wanted to have that information at hand so that they could assess aggressive transactions or transactions that were risk transactions. And lo and behold, the rules that we have in place are overstepping of that. They're more wide, they're more broad, and they do capture things that are not aggressive. So it's any transaction if you meet certain conditions. So these newer rules, which override the older rules, have come into play to be able to have CRA to have that ability to obtain that information in more detail and have it earlier so they can assess how they want to assess tax risk with those transactions. So these transactions came into place effectively for June 21st, 2023. And therefore, the notifiable and reportable transactions that occur after June 21st, 2023. It's also for transactions that will straddle that period. So for example, a person enters into a series of transactions before the 21st of June, and those transactions go into after June 22nd, and the minute that they have a transaction that is reportable or notifiable within that period after the 22nd, they're in the rules to report that transaction as one of the transactions in the notifiable reportable transactions. What I would say about these rules on the side is that the Joint Committee made a very specific comment that these rules were intended to be mirrored to the global rules that are coming into place with these types of reporting transactions. And they've made note of, and if you pull up the Joint Committee report and the appendix to the report, they make a note that the OECD commentary is that the Canadian rules are over and above the rules that were originally being noted by the OECD. Okay. So how do you get in these rules? What are these mandatory disclosure rules? And we've been through sort of a period of legislation, fixed to legislation, then a period of commentary, legislation coming into place, and now we're getting into positions where legislation is in place and people are reporting transactions. And so there's two criteria. The first is that you have to meet one of the three hallmarks. So the hallmarks being a contingent fee arrangement, confidential protection, and a contractual protection. But you also have to have an avoidance transaction. And the avoidance transaction is that it can be reasonably that it's one of the main purposes. So that's a key, one of the main purposes. A lot of our anti-avoidance rule, the new guards, moving towards this one of the main purposes instead of the primary purpose, or a primary purpose is, you know, for an other valid purpose, which are baked in the old mandatory disclosure rules, which specifically talked about you had to meet two of the hallmarks. Now you only meet one, and that the avoidance transaction had to be something that was you're carved out if it was other than for a primary purpose that was not primary for a tax benefit. Again, they've also put in place the reporting, which used to be reporting when you filed your tax return, to now this period much, much earlier, which we'll talk about in a second. Okay, so looking at these, the hallmarks, I'll go through each three hallmarks. So there's the contingent fee hallmark. So just flat out, the contingent fee hallmark, and I don't have this list on the slide, but the hallmark is effectively if your fee is based on the tax benefit, you fail. If the contingent fee or if there's a contingent fee to obtain a tax benefit or failure to obtain a tax benefit, okay, you fail, you've met the hallmark. Or if it's attributed to a number of taxpayers, so a tax plan goes in place and it's gonna be this much, this much, this much, because every taxpayer that's added on, it's another fee, another amount for that taxpayer. You would fail the hallmarks, or this hallmark. But we have some comfort in that there is some CRA commentary, and they talk about situations with financial institutions and the normal commercial business, and that fees are charged in those particular circumstances. Or now it's legislative that a fee for SR&ED, so SR&ED, scientific research and development type expenditures, a contingent fee in that range, those are allowed into the rules. Fees that are based on number of preparation filings. So I was talking about before that if a fee is based on the number of people involved, it's attributed to the number of people. This is a different look at it. This is where, say, you've got to file Section 85 rollover forms, 2057s. So you've got 20 taxpayers, it's gonna cost X amount per form. That's been said as being okay. And then there's this concept of value billing and whether value billing is allowed. And CRA's made some commentary that value billing would, in general, be allowed. But the value billing cannot be based on the tax benefit. It's got to be based on some other criteria. So criteria about the level and timing of experience of the person doing the work. The time that it takes for the people that are doing the work adds up to what they're billing. The degree of risk and the responsibility undertaken to do the work. The priority and importance of the work to the client, and then the value that the client is actually getting from that transaction would be valid other criteria to be included in value billing. So we've got a little bit more comfort in that part of it. The next hallmark would be the confidentiality hallmark. So this is the more simple one. Basically, it's a hallmark that says that you can't have confidentiality in your tax plan or your tax structure that specifically says that other people can't access it and see it. And more specifically, Revenue Canada doesn't have access to see that that transaction, something that prohibits CRA from seeing it. So without having those types of hallmarks in there, you should be okay. But if you got that hallmark, obviously it's a pretty small one to look at, you'd hit there. But CRA has made comments that it doesn't relate to normal IP and trademarks and things like that that don't have a tax element to it that they would allow confidentially for that. But you know, advisors are cautioned to review with legal counsel their engagement letters and make sure that there's nothing in those engagement letters that could just simply trigger this hallmark, because this hallmark would trigger it for all the parties involved in the transaction. The next hallmark is the contractual protection hallmark, and essentially this is a hallmark that provides some sort of insurance or protection against the failure of the transaction happening, the tax benefit not happening, or payments for expenses and reimbursements of expenses, interest and penalties that might be incurred by a person in the course of a dispute in reporting that tax benefit. CRA has obviously come back with some commentary and what does not include. So a limited liability clause in a professional engagement letter. Thank goodness, that's we're happy to see that. Standard reps and warrants in a normal purchase and sale agreement. Traditional reps and warrants that would go into those agreements, or some sort of contractual liability protection for liabilities that might exist in a business prior to the sale of that business. Those are all okay. There's standard price adjustment clauses, advanced income tax rulings, contingent litigation fee arrangements in relation to the appeal of a tax assessment. So that's something post. So if you're a lawyer that takes on, or tax advisor, you take on work to help with an appeal and it's contingent based on that appeal and you weren't involved in the original transaction, presumably you should be okay to have a contingent fee arrangement in that area. You know, a regular purchase and sale agreement, you got CDA protections, you got excessive eligible dividend exceptions, safe income calculation exceptions, things in that nature. Will those trigger the reportable transaction? We're not too sure yet. We'll be seeing how these rules pan out. Okay, so who must disclose? So a person who gets the benefit obviously has to disclose. a person who enters into the reportable transaction on behalf of that person would have to disclose. A promoter or an advisor who's entitled to a fee for that transaction, they will have to disclose. So if you meet one of the hallmarks, you would have to disclose as a promoter or an advisor. Or a person who does not deal at arm's length with that, that advisor and promoter. One thing in the changes of the rules, how they've panned out, there was a provision in the reportable transactions that said that if somebody didn't report, all those that were supposed to report are jointly and severally liable for the penalties, and that provision is thankfully has been taken out. So it's on an advisor by advisor, person by person responsibility to report, and it doesn't affect other people if that person or that group does not report. So that's a good thing. But the one thing they didn't change is the definition of an advisor. It's very, very broad, and it can capture anybody that provides assistance, advice for creating, developing, planning, executing, and implementing that transaction, and probably could go as far as the prepare of the tax return that puts those transactions through a tax return. So the advisor piece is very broad, so you know, buyer beware and make sure that you understand that. For the separate reporting, as long as there's not a confidentiality hallmark within the transaction, as long as you as the advisor don't have a contractual protection or you don't have a fee arrangement that puts you in the hallmark, presumably you should be okay and that you wouldn't have to report that transaction, even though somebody else might have to report that transaction. So what's the timeline? Chris might talk about this a little bit more, but the new form RC 312 is about 13, 14 pages long. It looks like you can check boxes and fill out a few things in it, but it's very extensive. Effectively, you'll have to report the transactions if you're reporting the step plan and that you do to legal counsel and things of that nature. It's very intrusive, it's a very long form, and it would take a significant amount of time and undertaking to fill the form out. As I said, the timelines were 45 days as opposed to filing with your income tax return with the old rules. That's now been extended, so now we have a 90-day window, which is very helpful. Although you're still reporting information quite early to Revenue Canada, that 90 days starts at the time you enter into a transaction or 90 days from you become contractually obligated to enter into that transaction. And why is this important? Well, the penalties. So penalties for failure for late filing, if you look at a larger corporation, $50 million in carrying value of assets, it's a $2,000 weekly penalty for late filing. To a greater of $100,000 or 25% of the tax benefit obtained. Large, large penalties. And all of the taxpayers, those that are don't meet the large $50 million threshold, it's $500. It's a greater $25,000, but again, 25% of the tax benefit that's being obtained. The reassessment period doesn't start till you file, and that could be 4 years. Or if you're a CCPC or an individual, it's your normal 3-year period. So it's important that you understand the statute barred period and filing on time. For promoters and advisors, the penalty is a little bit different. It's 100% of your fees, so whatever you charged, that's the first part of your penalty, plus $10,000, plus $1,000 each day for failure to report that transaction, up to a maximum of $100,000. So you're looking at, as an advisor, $110,000 plus your fee. There were some comments from the Joint Committee that went through that did not get addressed by the updated legislation or CRA commentary to date. I checked the website yesterday, and October 10th was the last time they updated it, but you actually can't see what they updated on their website. It's got a box for new, but that was something that was updated in September. But what the Joint Committee has come back with is there's no materiality for these mandatory disclosure rules. And if you look at the OECD model and you look at other countries like the UK, there are thresholds where you get into the reportable transaction. We don't have that here in Canada. So any transaction, if you trip a hallmark and it's an avoidance transaction, which is an easy test to trip up on, you would be in these reporting rules. And again, definition of advisor, they did ask for the advisor definition to get more granular what an advisor is and the role that the various advisors play in. And that has not been addressed in the new rules to date. And with that, I will turn it over to Chris on Notifiable.
Thanks, Paul. So notifiable transactions, I think you're going to see that the concept of a notifiable transaction really piggybacks on almost everything that Paul mentioned earlier. So the reportable transactions, there's a series of tests that need to be met. The notifiable transactions piggyback on a lot of those rules, with the caveat that the minister now has language in the Income Tax Act that says a transaction is notifiable if it is the same or substantially similar to one that they designate. And then the logical question that falls out of that is, what is substantially similar? And the CRA has opined that, you know, a substantially similar includes, effectively some GAR language in there. So are you expected to obtain the same or similar tax consequences? And they also note that, you know, this is to be interpreted broadly in favor of disclosure. So there, it's quite an onerous regime in a lot of ways when you think about it, if they're baking language in there that effectively works to their favor. The Minister of Revenue can designate these transactions, so not just finance, it's actually the Minister of National Revenue that can designate transactions in concurrence with the Minister of Finance. Okay, so in terms of notifiable transactions, very similar, who has to disclose, same as reportable transactions. And with a caveat that, you know, the legislation does provide an exemption for information that is protected by solicitor-client privilege. In terms of, you know, protecting yourself, if you know your corporation or you're going to be party to a notifiable transaction, well, you know, how can you protect yourself against application of penalties that Paul discussed and I will touch on again in a moment? Well, it's based on this concept of reasonable expectation to know. And what is a reasonable expectation to know? Well, only advisors who know or are reasonably expected to know of the reporting requirements are required to file. I don't really know what that means. It's kind of circular, but it is what it is. That's the guidance we have. But they have given us some examples here. So who's an advisor that's expected to report these things? And they try and carve out advisors who provide ancillary services or have narrow mandates that I guess don't technically understand the transaction as a whole. I don't know how much comfort that gives anybody, but that's the commentary that we have. How do you protect yourself from a due diligence perspective? The CRA's got some additional commentary out there where they say, you know, the person who's obtained the tax benefit would generally meet their due diligence obligations if they ask their advisor whether it's a notifiable transaction or not. Now, I guess the interesting caveat there, which Paul's touched on, is how many advisors do you need to consult? Because the definition of advisor is quite broad. So you could have multiple advisors in multiple stages of a transaction that you need to consult. Okay, notifiable transactions, again, disclosed on the same form as the reportable transactions. And as Paul noted, the disclosures on this form are actually quite extensive. So if you haven't looked at the form before because they came out relatively recently, I think I would encourage you to take a look. It's intrusive, I guess is how I would describe it, but maybe the Minister of Finance feels differently. Same due dates, as it's the same form. And again, same penalties and same comments on reassessment period for a notifiable transaction. So, like, I've discussed notifiable transaction and referenced that it piggybacks on the notion of reportable. But the logical question that everybody probably has is, well, what is a notifiable transaction? And the answer to that is, we don't know, because the minister has reserved the right to provide a list, but they haven't provided a list. And they haven't told us the form that list is going to take. They haven't told us where they're going to keep it, how they're going to update it, how they're going to remove things from it. So it's quite a large gap and a fair amount of uncertainty as to how we're going to be able to move forward with these rules. But you know, I guess at the end of the day, there's been a number of issues identified by the Joint Committee because of that. So, you know, in terms of the Joint Committee, the questions that are really outstanding are A, you know, how are you going to provide us with this list of notifiable transactions? B, are you going to give us some commentary or guidance on what constitutes substantially similar? You know, substantially similar is broadly a GAR concept, and there's voluminous amounts of guidance in that regard, but we don't have any in terms of notifiable transactions. And then the last question is if you have a series of transactions, well, what is the triggering point for the notifiable transaction? When do you have to identify it and disclose it as such? And it's not clear based on the commentary we have when that is, but the Joint Committee has proposed that the best triggering point to trigger, you know, notification to the Canada Revenue Agency would be, you know, at the time the benefit from this notifiable transaction is realized. And then moving on from notifiable transactions, there's a concept of reportable and certain tax treatments. So, you know, similar to what Jessica was alluding to with the EIFL rules and the importance of, you know, audited statements and all of, you know, that good stuff that gets baked in there. Now the CRA is coming after your tax provisions as well. So, and then certain tax treatment is defined as, an amount used or planned to be used in an entity's income tax filings for which there is uncertainty over whether the tax treatment will be accepted as being in accordance with tax law. So all the dinosaurs like me immediately start thinking back to like the US FIN 48 rules and how those have evolved over time. And I guess the concept here is broadly similar. The reporting mechanism itself is RC313. So a similar form to the one we discussed for reportable and notifiable transactions, but slightly different. And then I guess, you know, when do these things need to be reported? Well, the amount reported, it needs to be reported if it is new in the year or it has been reported in previous years. So unlike CRA past practice, which was reporting it once and you're done, you need to refresh these uncertain tax treatments in your reporting to them. And again, if you take a look at this form, you'll see very clearly that that's how they've structured the form. You're effectively disclosing each uncertain tax treatment on a line by line for each one. Commentary from the CRA that has come out, you know, in terms of the equity method of accounting exists, as well as partnerships. You know, partnerships in particular were an interesting case, and the question was, well, you know, do you need to disclose uncertain tax treatments with regards to partnership interests? And the series come back with an administrative position that, you know, if the reporting corporation meets the criteria, then any uncertain tax positions in the partnerships should also be included on that corporation's reporting form. No consolidated reporting. So each entity is required to file its own form. And then in terms of what has to be captured on these forms, the CRA has given us some clarity that it's, you know, restricted to Income Tax Act items. There's no need to disclose uncertain tax treatments for indirect taxes, provincial taxes, or foreign taxes. And then there was some questions about, well, what if I have a short taxation year for whatever reason? I have an amalgamation, acquisition of control. And the commentary that the CRA has given is that short taxation year also requires filing of the form for uncertain tax treatments. So when do you have to disclose uncertain tax treatments? The thresholds are actually pretty low. You have to file a Canadian income tax return. The entity has 50 million in assets at the end of the financial year, and it prepares audited financial statements in accordance with IFRS or country-specific GAAP. And obviously there's uncertainty as to a tax treatment in those statements. This is broadly dissimilar, or at least the threshold is significantly lower than what's happening again in the UK, where the, you know, the thresholds are, I think, up over 200 million. So Canada's gone quite low and cast quite a wide net with regards to uncertain tax treatments. So how do you disclose it? Again, RC313. And the due date for this particular form, unlike reportable and notifiable where you have 90 days, this one is due on or before the corporate income tax return deadline. The penalties are similar, but they're $2,000 a week to a maximum of $100,000. But that's for each uncertain tax treatment. So if you have multiple uncertain tax treatments, you can walk into multiple penalties of up to $100,000 and a similar reassessment period. So in terms of issues identified by the Joint Committee, the first one is really, you know, giving the serious subjective information on tax risks without safeguards might discourage practitioners from preparing that information at all, but I guess it is what it is at this point. Similar to what we discussed with reportable and notifiable transactions, there's no de minimis threshold. So, you know, if there is an uncertain tax treatment baked into the financials, material or not, it's captured by these rules and must be disclosed. And as we discussed earlier, the Joint Committee identified there's no exception for reporting amounts that the CRA is already aware of. So even if you've gone, if you've got amounts under objection, if you have amounts under appeal, you still have to report those on these forms. And if they go unreported, you're subject to penalties and they'll come at you with a hatchet, I guess.
This podcast was recorded live in Toronto, Canada on October 12th, 2023. The information in this podcast is provided for general informational purposes only. It may not reflect the current law in your jurisdiction, and it should not be taken as, and it is not intended to, render accounting, tax, legal, or other professional advice or services. This podcast is not intended as a substitute for professional tax advice. Listeners should not rely on, act upon, or fail to take any action based on the content or information found here without first seeking appropriate advice from an accountant, lawyer, or other qualified professional.